You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for coming to Brookings. Today, we're going to talk about the impacts of urbanization as a global megatrend and its focus on cities and how they respond. I think that if you're here, you probably already know that more than 50% of the world's population lives in urbanized areas. In about 30 years, we're going to be up to 66%. About 80% of all global GDP comes out of these urban areas. And the transformation of urbanization around the world increased in developed countries as well as developing countries has driven a lot of challenges. Economic reforms and the transition of how the economies behave and where economic centers are, infrastructure strains, the challenges of security with enormous numbers of people moving into areas that were not built for that population, and even the differences in how diplomacy happens. So all of these issues layered on top of our urban areas, creating challenges for them to respond. And one of the buzzwords over the past several years is resiliency. Are these places resilient? It's become a buzzword in many ways because the public sector uses it quite often for a whole range of themes, whether it's natural disasters or economic shocks. The private sector is using it to sell some of their products to respond to this. We're going to try and cut through that, from meaning all things to all people, with some analysis that has been done by our first speaker. And then we're going to have a conversation on these economic, social, security issues, where we're going to undoubtedly solve all of these urbanization problems. Except we can't, because I should mention one of our speakers today has been called off to the Hill for some testimony. I just wanted to mention Vonda Felba Brown, who actually was instrumental in pooling this together, so it's very unfortunate that she's not here. But she will be here tomorrow talking about security issues with our lead presenter, Dr. John DeBoer. He is currently the managing director of the SEC Dev Group. It's a new enterprise for him, but when he undertook this work, he was actually with the United Nations think tank, the Center for Policy Research under the United Nations University. And then after John speaks, we'll be joined by my colleagues, Alan Berube, who's a senior fellow and deputy director of the Metropolitan Policy Program, which focuses on cities, and then brings it together with our host today, actually, Mike O'Hanlon, who is senior fellow and leads the 21st Century Security and Intelligence Program within our foreign policy portion of Brookings. So we're great to be collaborating between foreign policy and our urban policy program. I'm Merrick Gutman. I'm just your moderator for today, and I am now going to turn this over to John for introductory remarks and a new tool on assessing and defining this issue of resiliency. So, John.
Thanks very much, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here, especially to escape the cold in Ottawa, believe it or not. But also to share some of the work that I've been involved in over the past several years. It's actually work that is a culmination of a lot of partnerships across the globe with a number of institutions and individuals, so it's particularly exciting. What I'm going to talk to you today is about not just resilience, but also fragility. You know, up until now, a lot of the work that's been discussed about fragility has been at the state level. But we know, as was mentioned earlier, we live in an urban environment. The majority of the world's globe live now in cities. Cities are, in fact, redefining global governance as we speak. And yet, we have very little understanding of what's taking place in these cities, very little understanding how various risks are dispersed or, you know, protective factors exist. So I'm very pleased to be able to share this work with you. The fact that the majority of the world's power, people, and wealth is concentrated in cities is actually a very good thing, particularly for tackling some of the world's most pressing issues. But I think we also have to recognize that cities are oftentimes at the front lines of facing some of the most dire constraints that were mentioned earlier, including climate change, urban violence, multi-layered levels of violence, as well as migration flows, and extreme poverty. Now, a lot is known about perhaps a half a dozen or maybe maximum 100 cities, our global cities, the ones that dominate global GDP. But the reality is that we know very little about the majority of the world's cities. In fact, our knowledge base is probably almost non-existent. And most likely, considering projections in terms of population growth, considering projections in terms of economic growth, it's those cities that we know very little about that are going to shape our future. And so what we did in collaboration with the Igarapé Institute, the United Nations University, which I was formerly a part of, as well as with the support of the 100 Resilient Cities Initiative and the World Economic Forum, was to put together a framework that enabled us to, A, understand the types of risks that are facing the majority of our world cities, as well as some of the opportunities that they can harness to deal with some of the challenges that they face. Why is this important? Well, think for now, if you look and trust at what McKinsey says, 40% of global growth over the next 10 years will come from cities in emerging contexts. 70% of growth in sub-Saharan Africa will come from its cities. 80% in Latin America will come from cities, and about 66% over the next 10 years will come from cities. Cities are fundamental to growth, not just in the United States and elsewhere, but around the globe. And unless we understand their realities on the ground, it's going to be difficult to navigate the complications. And so what we tried to do in collaboration with Igarapé and others is to find a way to systematically compare, contrast, and understand the risks facing cities. What you have here is a data visualization that we've put together where we examined over 2,100 cities with populations of 250,000 or more. And what we did was to create a framework that highlighted, isolated, 11 variables. And these variables were based on academic literature, and they had to have an empirical correlation with indicators of fragility in cities. Some of the indicators included the rate of urban population growth, unemployment, particularly youth unemployment, income and social inequality, access to basic services, levels of pollution, homicide rates, terrorism-related deaths, as well as conflict events, and of course, natural hazards, such as exposure to cyclones, floods, droughts. So what we did here, what you have is a composite index that doesn't just look at conflict-related or security-related threats, but also tries to bring together a wide variety of risks that a city may face, and try to understand how they link together, how they aggregate. As I mentioned, there were a couple of criteria for defining these 11 variables. More information is available online at cpr.edu. But the two key defining characteristics of why we chose these 11 variables was, one, there had to be empirical evidence of a correlation with fragility at a second level. Secondly, and this is more of a constraining variable, that there had to be actual data that we had to collect at the city level across these 2,100 cities, right? And I'll get to this later, perhaps in more of a question and answer period. There are certain limitations, as you all are aware, that relate to the quality and availability of data at the city level. And what we did was to scour both structured and unstructured data sources coming from national statistics offices, international organizations, both private as well as public sources, to categorize these and gather them over a 15-year period. So our data set goes back to the year 2000. And if you go on the website, which is publicly available, you can actually click on a button and it will actually simulate how fragility has progressed and changed over the past 15 years. And we rated them in a scale of 1 to 4. 1 being low fragility, 4 being high fragility. Now, there were a number of interesting conclusions and findings, I suppose, when we went about collecting these data and compiling it into this data visualization. I'll speak to 4. There are many others. But the first one is that city fragility at the city level, was more widespread than we originally thought. And probably worse. If you look back 10, 15 years, it's actually growing. So of the sample of 2,100 cities that we looked at, roughly 14%, just over 300, actually can be considered very fragile. And 16%, only 16%, are actually considered to have low fragility. The vast majority of the world's 2,100 cities, over 250,000 people, are actually in the middle range of mid-level degrees of fragility. The second interesting lesson that we learned was that, and perhaps it's not new to all of you, nor surprising, that yes, most fragile cities are clustered in Africa and Asia. In fact, 93% of all high-risk cities are located on those continents. 44% of all cities in Africa are classified as high fragility. Approximately 51% are of medium levels. By comparison, when you look at Asia, and that includes the Middle East, roughly 70% of their cities experience medium levels of fragility, and some 15% exhibit very high levels of fragility. Now, some of the factors driving fragility in Africa, for example, include very high unemployment, particularly amongst young men, low access to services, as well as, of course, exposure to conflict and violence. In Asia, the key influencing factors tend to be related to exposure to hazards, particularly natural hazards, terrorism-related killings, as well as high levels of exposure to air pollution. And in the Americas, homicidal violence and organized crime tend to be some of the most important variables. Now, the third key finding that we found was that areas or cities that are experiencing either high or moderate levels of fragility are not confined to low or middle-income settings, right? In fact, you see approximately 40 cities in upper middle-income settings that show signs of high levels of fragility. And increasing levels of fragility. A lot of them are concentrated in Colombia, others obviously increasingly in Venezuela. And you also see countries such as the Philippines experiencing very high rates of fragility. Now, the good news is that fragility is not permanent. It's something that you can change. It's a dynamic property. And you have examples of cities able to turn things around. I mean, we were talking before we came in here about Medellin, an often cited example. But you also can go back into history where, for instance, I was working for the past 3 years, Tokyo. Tokyo was not always a thriving city as it is now. I mean, you just need to go back to the right after the post-war period, rampant with organized crime, obvious exposure to natural hazards, serious political instability. Look at where Tokyo is today. It's not an inevitable outcome. But in order to get or escape fragility, manage fragility and these risks, there's a couple of things that are required. They often require, obviously, enlightened leadership. They require mayors who stick to a plan, successive mayors. But as part of this research, we also mapped out what we call protective factors, a series of what we thought to be some of the most important attributes that a city could have in order to deal with the risks that I highlighted earlier. And there's seven here. The first deals with greater income and social inequality. There's considerable empirical evidence that greater income and social equality are not only correlated with the ability to deal with disaster, but also to deal with violence and crime. Effective policing and judicial systems. Now, it's not just the number of police that's important. In fact, there's absolutely no correlation between the number of police and security on the ground. It's public confidence and trust in the police at the city level that seems to be the most important factor. When there is higher degrees of public trust in the institutions of law enforcement, there seems to be greater compliance with the law and obviously greater cooperation with the law. Third, microeconomic security and social protection schemes. Here we're talking about savings, insurance schemes, access to credit. These are fundamental, not just in terms of dealing with disaster, but also in preventing violence and recidivism. Access to basic services, not only as a measure of the degree of development at a city level, but also to help them rebound and recover. Greater social cohesion, not just within groups, but also between groups. The existence of social support networks, right? And here we're talking about not just in terms of community associations and churches, but also direct interventions that help social reintegration of violent offenders, for example, that help them deal with, you know, CBT, which is the cognitive behavioral therapy, develop nonviolent networks, etc. These prove to be very important initiatives, high value for investment. And finally, and perhaps not least significant, is that there has to be very important and strong forms of cooperation between communities and their government. Collective community support, to work with municipal government and multiple layers of government. And of course, intergovernmental cooperation seems to be fundamental in terms of dealing with some of the fragility risks that I mentioned. Now, in conclusion, what's obvious from this is that a number of entities across the public and private sector have a role to play, right? We're talking about not just government or police, but we're talking about insurance providers. We're talking about banks. We're talking about community groups, leaders. All of them having a role to play in terms of developing the attributes and the protective factors to deal with fragility. And I'll close by saying that we should not also think about fragility and resilience as being on opposite sides of the spectrum. In fact, oftentimes, they coexist. You will find some of the most resilient communities and resilient peoples in contexts of high fragility. The challenge for policymakers and the challenge for the private sector is, how do you harness that to scale it up, to build capabilities to help manage risks better, and to help diminish and mitigate against the impact of some of the risks that I managed. Thanks. I look forward to engaging on this more as we talk through the questions and answering period.
So I'll also actually start, we want to take a lot of questions from you all, so start thinking about responses. I'll just ask a quick question to John and then maybe get some early feedback from Alan and Mike and begin the conversation with you all as well. So John, one of the things is, and it was interesting because when I led with resilience, you led with fragility, you kind of addressed the distinction between the two of them. Could you just get a little bit more detail on that definition of fragility versus resilience? Because I think that's something that is not well recognized among a lot of practitioners.
Yeah. So what we've been doing in terms of trying to think through these two concepts, which as you mentioned earlier on are extremely vague, right, was to focus on core capacities of the cities. So when we look at fragility, what determines and defines a fragile city versus a non-fragile city is actually looking at its capacity to deliver on its social contract with the people, to deliver on its core capacities, right? So some of that can include delivering on basic services, but it also includes protecting property, individuals, and moving forward on social norms, right? So core capacities. Resilience, we interpret it more as protective capacities, the factors, the ability to actually help isolate, insulate those core capacities so that when a city actually faces a certain type of crises, whether it be sudden onset or chronic, it's able to actually deliver on the minimal capacity, to harness also collaborative mechanisms, whether it be at the community level or within the private sector, or externally, to help deal with those issues and those challenges. The other important thing that I think that I mentioned at the conclusion is that we should not think that resilience is always good, right? I mean, there have been people, Diane Davies, for example, at Harvard, who have talked about negative resiliency, right? And you see this happening all the time in many contexts in which we work. Conflict-affected contexts, crime-ridden contexts, service providers sometimes are illicit groups, organized crime. And communities are forced to trust them or to rely on them for security provision, sometimes for even basic things as latrines, right? That is a resilience mechanism, but it actually enhances fragility of the community. Right? So how can you think through alternative modes of building up resilience that don't actually enhance fragility? So here we need to understand kind of the linkages between these two factors. So
I'm interpreting this as fragility are the kind of risk factors and how at risk you are based upon a lot of external and some internal structures, right, or environmental. And then resilience is your capacity to either mitigate or respond to those risks?
That's right. It's capacity to mitigate or respond to those risks. And what's interesting is that they're not always the inverse. So for instance, what I showed there, there's nothing in the fragility factors that talk about, for instance, social cohesion, right? That talk about microeconomic security schemes, insurance, et cetera. They're not always the reverse of the other. And so we need to think through those. So this is obviously somewhat of a first take. We need to take a much more deeper dive in terms of how these various factors interrelate and react on the ground in some of the most complex environments.
So just one more question then about the application, yeah, of this platform. What were you trying to do, or what do you hope comes out? This is data. Yeah. It gives people a sense of where they are. There's a lot more places. I mean, we just did a redefining global cities analysis. And there's an annual global metro or regular global metro monitor that looks at, again, like the top 300, top 120 some places in each of those instances. You cover a lot more. So what are you hoping is the practical result from making this available?
So the first practical result is, A, it's never been done before, right? This does represent the single largest public repository of data on cities across multiple risks, right? The second thing that we want is for cities to react and say, what? This is inaccurate, or what are we doing here? Update this data, because I mentioned earlier, some of the limitations with this is that data, particularly when you're dealing with cities such as Mogadishu or even Karachi, is scarce, unreliable, right? Needs to be scrubbed significantly. And so we want an interaction, a communication with cities to help improve the database. A lot is riding on good data in terms of good public policy. The other thing that we want is a much more in-depth interrogation of what we mean by resilience earlier, what we mean by fragility. We also want people to get beyond looking at the nation state-based approach to approaching investments, whether it be businesses or others. You know, some of the most viable cities in the world are actually in very unstable environments, right? Some of the most unviable cities are in very stable environments, or technically country-based environments. So here we need to start understanding at a much more micro level what's happening. The other final thing I'll say is that this is not meant to be a standalone product, right? So it's meant to complement a lot of the work that you're doing, that Mike, you know, will introduce here in terms of ingrained, on-the-ground, focused studies of what's actually required to improve things, you know, at a micro level. And this is an entry point to say, okay, how are we doing? What's the baseline? Can we track progress over the next 10, 15 years based on some of these indicators? And then can we see if, hey, things are getting better or not?
So, Alan, you do a lot of work on the economic side, social economic viability of city regions, most of it in the United States, some international. I'm going to ask you a very open-ended question about how you think, so obviously you can respond however you like, how you think that this framework relates to the kinds of analysis that you've been doing around economic growth and poverty issues and so on, either in the U.S. or transferable to international experience.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, fragility for me is a sort of new concept, not something I'm especially steeped in the U.S. context or in thinking about the economies of cities, but I want to credit John and his colleagues for what I think are three key values I sort of immediately saw in the fragility framework. The first is actually sort of bringing to light these conditions in the cities of the global south, and when, as you said, these big global cities in the north tend to hog the limelight, right? And I saw a talk that your co-author, Rob Mugga, gave where he said that the narrative about cities in the global context right now is Ed Glaser's triumph of the city and it's Richard Florida's creative class and it's Ben Barber's If Mayors Ruled the World and it's our colleague Bruce Katz's Metropolitan Revolution. Cities are the sites of power and innovation and economic leadership. But there are a lot of cities for whom that's not uniformly the case. So I think shedding additional attention on the conditions in those cities, the kinds of challenges that they're facing is a key value. The second is, as you articulated really well, John, is just extending what I understand to be this concept of fragility as a nation state concept right. to the city level. And I think that's really analogous to the efforts that we've been putting towards the, you know, taking the notion of a national economy to the city level over so many years, because that is where the conditions that create economic value and growth emanate from. And I think as you're showing, it's where the conditions that create fragility at the nation state level often bubble up from the cities themselves. And then the third, I think, as you look at the factors that you defined as sort of adding up to or contributing to fragility, I think this marriage between the not only the deficits in governance, mm-hmm. right, and insecurity, but also the underlying economic and social conditions of a place, that these sort of knit together in mm-hmm. complicated ways, and you have to take both things into account as you think about this sort of squishy concept of fragility. I think that's a signature contribution and allowed me to think differently about U.S. cities, sort of who's fragile and who's not. And most of them tend to be in your low to low moderate categories, but there is a continuum there. Mm-hmm. But I think less familiarity in our domestic context with what it means to be a more or less fragile place that I think we could get some value from. So let me just, so that's the framework. I think, you know, the empirical exercise is in some ways the more difficult thing, and it's hard to operationalize this stuff in an index. Merrick alluded to this Global Metro Monitor that we do, which is for 300 global, the largest, like many of these globally significant metropolitan areas, and just getting data about the size of their economy, the number of jobs that they have, like really basic economic indicators defined consistently in terms of the concept and then the geography across places, like that'll make you tear your hair out. Mm-hmm. You did it for 2,100 cities across 11 very disparate kinds of indicators, so you should just, we should just give you a round of applause and let you go home after doing that. That's a pretty amazing exercise. One question or comment I had in sort of looking through it. So the factors that you chose, and I think this relates probably to the fragility literature, of which I'm less familiar, based on the factors are based on their sort of link to violence and crime mm-hmm. in the first instance, right? Key outcomes or manifestations of fragility, as you call them in the report. When you actually operationalize those concepts and those factors in the index itself across these 11 indicators, you end up with this sort of combination of indicators that are themselves directly measuring violence and crime in cities. So there's homicide rate, armed conflicts, terrorist killings, etc. And sort of alongside what are fundamentally economic and social measures that are perhaps thought to contribute to those outcomes mm-hmm. of violence and crime, the rapid growth, income inequality, unemployment, air quality, for instance. So I kind of wondered, and it might be good to just talk mm-hmm. a little bit about, is this mixing cause and effect, or is fragility really a big enough umbrella to envelop both of those kinds of measures? And then I just finally observe about the fragility stuff that I do think it's a really important contribution. A couple of the things that you link here, the rapid population growth yeah. and income inequality as contributors to fragility, contributors to violence and crime, where I'd say the growth is mainly a destabilizing factor in the global south. Our cities in the global north aren't growing at a pace where it actually they want growth, right? Many of them are in sort of demographic stasis or decline. So to the extent they can get population growth, it's generally thought to be a good thing in adding to the economy and adding to vitality. Not always the case in the global south because they're growing much faster and they're growing for very different reasons than cities of the global north grow. Mm-hmm. And then I think income inequality, sort of putting that into the mix is something that can contribute to fragility. We actually find this link, as you noted in the report, between income inequality and increased violence and instability mm-hmm. in cities in the United States. And I do research on income inequality in the United States. And what does it mean? And I always think about, what are the economic impacts of this? But I think it's a real contribution to flag the fact that income inequality, for many reasons, can actually lead to greater social distance in a society and lead to real negative outcomes for a population and strains on fiscal resources. So there's a lot. I think there's a lot to admire and like in what John and his colleagues have done. And some questions, too. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
So before actually I segue to Mike, why don't you get at that question about cause and effect?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this is a difficult issue to disentangle. And it's subject of much discussion, both at the national level and at the city level, right? How we treated it within the context of this, and I should premise my response with the fact that a lot of the people that worked on this come from the security domain, mm-hmm. right? That's our point of departure. But we did also involve a physician, emergency physician from Stanford, urban planners, others into the discussion to try and go beyond just our own common silos.
See, that was your problem, is going multidisciplinary.
That's there you go. Yeah, it's a challenge. That's a sin. But what we understood is, look, violence is actually a manifestation of fragility. And fragility, as I defined it earlier, is the capacity of a municipal government, in this case, to actually deliver on its core services, right? So if violence is an outcome, then we're looking at indicators, right, that correlate with that outcome. And that's why we have the 11 variables there. Now, in the case of homicide, obviously, there is a very close interlinkage, right, between them. But there are other indicators that are very interesting and actually are not new to people who have studied criminology, et cetera, deal with issues of collective, you know, efficacy, right, social cohesion, et cetera. It's just that those kinds of studies have not translated into, you know, consciousness when it comes to urban planners, et cetera. And so these are the kinds of bridges that we're making.
So actually one of the benefits of this look is to get across that problem of you've got this siloed group of urban planners dealing with the infrastructure side, and then you've got the economic development professionals worrying about economy or sometimes poverty, and then you've got people dealing with security, and this brings it together, saying that, you know, it's the aggregation of those things that makes it fragile.
So actually,
the most interesting thing you just said from your presentation to me was the consistency of, you know, the drivers of fragility across some of these geographies. And, you know, you had unemployment in Africa, but you had conflict. And then you had environmental issues in Asia, and you had terrorism and conflict. And then in the sort of the Americas, you had crime and violence. So that's the one thing that you at least expressed in this overview about security being the central driver in all of these places for questions of fragility, which is perfect because Mike O'Hanlon recently completed an analysis called Securing Global Cities, where you visited a lot of the places on the map that were in red, right? And looked at these kinds of issues about the relationship between security and economic growth and some of these other factors about how you respond to that. So can you just give a really quick overview of the kinds of work that you did and how it relates to some of these fragility and resiliency findings?
Yeah, thank you, Merrick, and hats off as well to John and what you folks have done. Really impressive. So I had the pleasure of doing this year-long project with General Ray Odierno, former Army chief and Iraq war commander. And when he was Army chief of staff in the United States from 2011 to 2015, he commissioned a study called Megacities, which tried to get at some of the same kinds of questions we're talking about, but more from a security point of view. He came into this project really thinking that we needed to, you know, take off our military planner caps and learn some things about what police do and first responders and others who are involved in the more day-to-day real stuff for most cities. Because as much as in war zones, the military commanders may be preeminent, in most cities, they are at most in a support role, and that's ideally the way it will stay. So we tried to look at a number of best practices. We didn't claim that we could, as one former war hero, Ray Odierno, and one longtime woolly-headed think tank analyst, me, who does national defense myself, we didn't really think we could solve too many city security challenges. We thought we could collect best practices and listen to people as they told us what worked in a number of cities, including some cities that are doing pretty well or have made progress. And so just a few things that stood out from that year-long effort in my mind. First of all, I'm just going to reiterate, you know, it's always just so dramatic, and you folks do it extremely well in Metropolitan Studies. John did it today, to remind us all of the numbers of how things are changing. And you mentioned how more than half the world's population is now in cities, and it'll be two-thirds by mid-century. And another way to look at it is that in 1950, less than 1 billion people on Earth lived in cities. Only about a third of the world's total at that time, less than 1 billion. By 2050, just to apply your 66% number to the expected population of 9 billion, we will have 6 billion in cities. So it's more than a six-fold increase in urban population. So the global population will have tripled over that time, but urban population will have gone up by six-fold. So that's just a remarkable change. You know, if you want to summarize, I think, what's happening demographically in the world, I never knew this until this, I never thought about it in these terms until this study, but the 20th and 21st centuries are presumably, in the great history of mankind, the years that we are filling up the earth with people and sticking them in cities. That's basically the demographic short story. And if the human species survives many more centuries, which I hope it will, then it's hard to believe that there'll ever be centuries where there's as much growth or as much urbanization as is happening right now. That's sort of where we are in the grand sweep of history. It's really a very, you know, central fact, and it underscores the importance of your research program and your study. So that's just a long-winded way of complimenting you all for what you do. Another thing that I really liked about the way that you described the patterns of global violence, and we came upon this in our work as well, is that when people think of terrorism, which, of course, is often the headline grabber, it's by far and away of the various major causes of preventable death in cities, it's by far and away the smallest compared to almost anything else you could want to identify by way of a big category. And so the numbers are that about maybe 30,000 people a year are dying from terrorism, almost all in Muslim countries from other Muslims. Very few of these are attacks in the West, statistically and numerically, even if those are the ones that get the biggest headlines. And then there are about 100,000 people a year dying from civil wars around the world. You know, obviously it can vary a bit depending on what's happening in Syria or Yemen at a time. And then there are about 400,000 plus people a year who are murdered. And you mentioned the Americas and the challenge we have here and also in much of Africa. And then there are, you know, this is sort of a little bit of a different category, but there are more than 1 million a year who die from car accidents. And so if you think about what you're trying to do with urban security, these numbers help remind you of where the real chief challenges need to be addressed. That's just a second broad framing point. A third thing that really struck me as I tried to learn some of the literature that you folks have generated and that you know well is, and it gets to the fragility concept, is that, of course, human beings are living better than ever before. A higher fraction of the world's population is living better than ever before. We are in the midst of a great period of progress in the fight against poverty. And my good friend Ken Lieberthal and others who work on China have helped make this possible in the world's most populous country. But it's happened in many other places as well. And so that's tremendous. But if you think about how it's happened, it's often sort of progress, not just in developing countries, but here too, on top of rickety infrastructure, electricity grids that could go down, water systems that may not survive some kind of a one-time violent episode, whether man-made or natural. And so we are creating all this prosperity on top of an increasingly fragile infrastructure. Because, you know, I think back to my Peace Corps days in one of the cities that I think does make the list, Kikwit, DRC. I think it was about 150,000 then. Now it's about 750,000 people. And Kikwit just sort of reverted back into the jungle under Mobutu. And so it doesn't depend on rickety infrastructure so much. People are living subsistence even within the city. But in most places, you have people depending on refrigerated food, on water coming through their pipes. And when these systems break, you know, if they break small and they break piecemeal, you can fix them. But if they break in a catastrophic event, then you could have a far greater catastrophe than we've really seen in most episodes in modern human history, at least in terms of one-off catastrophes. And I was struck looking at the various catastrophes that we're familiar with in the last 20 years. So whether it's the Haiti earthquake or the tsunami of 2004 or the Fukushima disaster in Japan, some of the earthquakes in South Asia, these have been tragic. A lot of people have died, but they've typically hit city areas of 1 or 2 or 3 million. And the next time it could be 10 or 20 or 30 million. And we are, in a sense, going to have to get ready for that. You know, and this is where some of General Odierno's military background did come in handy in the thinking about this, the responses. Because if you got to that scale of a disaster, you would need, in effect, to at least partially militarize the response temporarily. And so this got us thinking about catastrophes and how to, you know, to some extent, urban architecture and design can mitigate against these kinds of concerns. If you have various access points for authorities, if you don't just have mega slums that make areas almost, you know, unapproachable. And so there is an element to which you can make cities more, you know, more resilient if you plan the city. And this, I think, is sort of the flip side of the research you all have done that show that these fast-growing cities are the most vulnerable for this kind of reason. And then just a couple more points, and I'll be done. Thank you for letting me meander a little as I try to, you know.
I can't stop you once you get going.
it can be difficult, yeah. Just about done, because really what I want to say is just two more things. First of all, in the United States context, and I'm sure this is true in many countries, partly because of that potential for large-scale catastrophe, partly because of things like Ebola, globalization that allows threats to quickly spread from place to place, urban security is becoming national security. Mm-hmm. That was one of General Odierno's big sound bites by the end of the project. And we asked Mayor Landrieu from New Orleans to come up and help us make that argument, which he was more than happy to do, because he feels that, you know, up here in the Washington debates, we talk about national security and we pump up the defense budget by $54 billion. And part of how we do that is to take from those little FBI programs and justice programs like COPS that are already smaller than they used to be. And as if the urban security mission could just be totally relegated to local authorities and it had no consequence for broader national security. So I was glad he opened up that debate. And I'll just put it there in conceptual terms without trying to draw out a lot of budgetary implications. But it's troubling to see. That's one more reason why, even though I support President Trump's proposed $54 billion defense increase. I don't like at all how he's proposing to pay for it. And I think we're going to have to do it by either, you know, tax revenue or some other kind of concept, not from stealing from diplomacy, foreign aid, urban security, and so forth. Very last point. One more thing that troubled me in the 2016 presidential debate as it unfolded, and sort of the state of this conversation in our country. It might be getting a little better now because maybe it was more politicized in the campaign. But, of course, with the issues with body cameras and police misbehavior and police crime in a number of cases, that became very prominent. We got a little bit of a cleavage in our society where people were tending to choose sides between either the police or the community, the police or the racial minorities quite often that the police were protecting. And we all know this is a totally unproductive way to think. And if there's one central thing that General Odierno and I learned about urban security, it's that concepts like community policing are the only thing that work. In other words, everybody buying in together. You can define community policing different ways. There are debates about just how to do it best, what exactly it means tactically. But the whole concept of having a lot of police getting to know and working with a lot of communities, private actors as well as neighborhood activists and other kinds of representatives of the troubled communities themselves. This is the only way you have any chance of securing these communities. So we need police, and if there are problems with police, we have to help them get better. We can't, you know, get into a sort of a polarizing debate about their overall approach, recognizing, of course, that individual crimes must be punished and individual mistakes must be remedied, and sometimes police forces need makeovers. But I'd rather see the debate in those terms than some of what I think we've heard over the last couple of years.
So I'm going to ask one more question and then start taking yours. Prepare your phrasing. But built off of this, I mean, there's this discussion, you mentioned it earlier, John, about the lack of recognition or the fact that we've been looking at these fragility issues through the national or nation-state lens for a long time without the recognition or even empowerment of the fact that there are these metropolitan, you know, urbanized areas that are really where things are happening, whether it's security or economy and so on. So I'm curious what the reception, this coming out of the UN, right, this project, what the reception has been or the reaction of the nation-states or the other recipients of information, like, okay, but we're really concerned about the countries. Mm-hmm. What's been the feedback?
So it's a great, great question. As you know, the UN came out with the Sustainable Development Goals. One of those goals, goals number 7, is on cities, right? I think the UN has woken up to the idea that, look, not only do we have to understand how to deal with some of the key problems that cities are facing, but secondly, they could be a great ally in tackling some of the greatest challenges. Climate change is one example. I mean, nation states have a problem getting together and agreeing to an action plan. Cities are already on their way. Why? Because their survival depends on it, right? There's also corporations behind it that see a lot of opportunity. So the United Nations has kind of understood that. It's also facing a financial crisis. And it needs to adapt to the 21st century. And so at the UN level, I think people are starting to come around to the idea. But the question is how, right? It is a member states-based organization, essentially a union of member states. And oftentimes, in many of the contexts we're dealing with, and I'm not speaking on behalf of the UN now, states, federal governments are not necessarily allies of their mayors or their localities, right? They're competing for minimal resources. A great example is in Senegal, a couple of years ago, one of the key challenges for cities, as you know, is actually having access to credit, right? Commercial credit. Senegal managed to get actually approval. They were about to announce it with World Bank support, et cetera. On that day, that announcement was canceled because the central government said, we don't want you going ahead with this. We're not giving you authorization. The tendency is to look at these things as somebody taking a cut from a very limited pie. I think we need to change that chip. The United Nations has a big role to play in terms of creating a new dynamic, working with a number of organizations on the humanitarian front. We're already making progress. Well, there's a global alliance on urban crisis. There are a number of other areas. So I think reception has been mixed, but I think people realize that this is the future. And as Mike mentioned, urban security is national security, right? Urban growth is national growth as well. Urban health is global health. So these interconnections in a completely interconnected world, I think for me is a no-brainer.
Questions? I will start with you. You raised your hand first. Yes, sir.
So my name is Anash, International Urban Alliance. John, congratulations. Fascinating.
Microphone coming up.
Thank you. Anash, International Urban Alliance. I'm an urban planner. John, fascinating report, real tour de force. And I hope the data are available and public. I would be very interested. The question is, how can you detect hidden fragility? Simple example, Wall Street looked great in 2006, and it was hollow on the inside. And X-ray doesn't work, MRI doesn't work. Can you perform a biopsy? And if so, which would be the instruments? Thank you.
Ask them right away?
Okay. Sure. Well,
thanks very much, Anash. Merci beaucoup. I think it's a great question. What we've done in terms of these indicators are also kind of red flags, right? So one of the ideas about putting together this, it is publicly available. You can go there. You can hover over each city. You can also run regressions, right, on it and see the exact data. The idea is to say, if we're able to track these over time and see trends over time, then we're able to say, okay, there are a number of factors that are worrying here. For instance, let's look at Syria, right? Some of the cities there. I mean, right before the crisis, and I'm not saying that this is the only cause, but there was 75% loss of livestock. 80% of the crop was lost due to drought, etc. I mean, you're seeing the interconnections between what were not commonly understood as causes, say, of instability, violence, etc., and large-scale violence. So here, what we need to be attuned to, I think, are these red flags, warning signs. The private sector actually does this really well, particularly the insurance industry, right? And so here, I think working with alliances like the insurance industry, elsewhere, having an understanding also with urban planners in terms of what are the lifespan generally of certain infrastructures, what are probable scenarios based on, you know, certain projections. These are the kinds of thinking I think we need to get into, based on data, improving the database, working with governments not to identify necessarily culprits, but to try and solve problems.
And I suppose unstructured data helps.
That's right, absolutely. The only thing is, and I'll say that, you know, the majority of the data that's out there on cities is in private hands. For this, thankfully, we work with Swiss Re that were able and willing to give the data on hazards. We also work with Siemens, which have a huge amount of access to data. But if you're talking about security, private security companies have incredible data in many of the areas that we're not able to access. So here we need, you know, a data revolution, if you will, a compact to work with these corporations to develop a robust database.
We're going to go across and then come back to you. Go ahead.
Yep.
Thank you very much. June O'Connell, former U.S. diplomat. I'm confused as to whether or not you can just clarify, if your study also looked at the primary stimulus for the growth of the cities. So some are stimulated by food insecurity. Some in India, one would think that mostly it's job opportunities. I mean, it's urbanizing. So the extent to which fragility is reflected by the fact that the urbanization might have been stimulated by instability versus natural course. So just whether or not that was within the scope of what you were looking at, thank you.
Great question. We weren't able to go to that level of granularity. What we did was to try and isolate those 11 variables that would allow us to compare and contrast across continents, across cities, right? It's not necessarily as vertical of an investigation as we'd like. So that's where the complementarity with focused studies needs to happen. But I think generally speaking, when you're looking at, for instance, an aggregation of multiple risks, it allows us to touch on a variety of probable causes, right, for fragility. So we can approximate that, but we can't get down to the exact. I think that would be definitely the next step in research like this, is to take a framework such as this, test it out on the ground, right? Undertake case study-based analysis that allows us to go in-depth into the particular drivers of whether it be resilience or fragility, growth, et cetera, in these places.
Some cities like Latin America have been, Brazil, whatever, have been experienced significant growth in part because that's where opportunities were perceived. So each younger generation moved more and more to the cities, more and more children. Other places, the growth of the city has been because of insecurity in the countryside. So I was, it's actually a pre to what you're studying, whether or not you were able to look at that. And I appreciate that the answer is no. I mean, I appreciate that.
We're right there, that gentleman, and then we'll come back to
you. Lou Gagliano. My question is primarily concentrated on the U.S., and the other framing question, other framing thing I would say is that urbanization complicates healthcare delivery tremendously in the United States. I can't speak to the rest of the world. But the real heart of what I have seen that works in the inner city is changing the dynamics of households relative to stability of income, workforce development, et cetera. And what I haven't seen well done, at least in the United States, is the transfer of the concepts of what works best, so that we're harvesting and taking the lessons learned and changing the dynamics of what goes on in our inner cities, and that would apply to me throughout the world. So I'd like somebody to comment on how good or bad you've seen that happen, and whether you believe your work will lead to that improved basis for those migration patterns.
I would only concur with the questioner that the lateral transfer of effective practice for poverty alleviation and mitigation of instability in inner cities has not been robust in the United States. It's often sort of every neighborhood on its own, or maybe every city on its own, sort of wrestling with what ultimately are similar sets of issues. But they, you know, the other thing that they share is, frankly, I'd say not enough resources in the main to tackle the scale of the challenges that inner city communities face. But certainly there are many efficiencies to be gained, I think, by networking people and practitioners more effectively around the issues of education and workforce development, economic development strategies in cities. We see a lot of the same bad ideas tried out time after time, just because they're easy to do, or you know, somebody knows that we did that 30 years ago, so why don't we try that again? So that's what we work on at the Metropolitan Policy Program. We're only 40 people, so we can only get to so many places. But I would not be surprised if, in the international context, and I don't know if it's in the developed or the developing context, that there are better examples that the United States should borrow from in terms of how to network people more effectively around the sharing of best practice interventions for these kinds of communities.
I mean, there are 200 some international city networks on a variety of issues, C40 and climate change. And in Europe, there's the EU organizes around security issues, and even at the local level, security exchange. Do you all have any other comments on this?
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing I will say is, you know, I'm optimistic because mayors have to be problem solvers in a way, right? And the other thing is that the mayors I've talked to instinctively want to learn from other mayors, right? They talk. Now, are they learning the right lessons? Mm-hmm. Is a question, Mark. Is there the evidence base behind it to kind of underpin a longer trajectory of analysis of what works and what doesn't? That's still wanting. But I think that there's an inclination and the desire and the need to move forward. The other thing I'll mention is, we're talking a lot about urban here, and oftentimes one of the criticisms I get is, well, what about the rural, right?
We get that a lot, too. Yeah, I never know what to say. But go ahead. Yeah.
They're intimately interconnected. Intimately interconnected, as you know. Most people living in the city, particularly in Africa, come from rural villages, right? So they're interconnected in multiple ways. And here we have to find better ways of kind of bridging the two, of thinking about how they can work together to solve, multiple issues, to prevent, mitigate against crisis. One of the greatest examples is Ebola and how that trafficked, right, from the city into rural areas, et cetera. So here we have to think through these connections as well, both as urban planners, but also as policymakers.
Say one more thing on Ebola. Wow, did we get lucky? Or wow, did people do a good job on the ground? And the next time, what if Liberia and Sierra Leone had still been at war when the thing struck? Could we really have plausibly hoped to quarantine it? What if those 12 cases that got to Nigeria had spread? I still don't know how the Nigerians dealt with that so well. And I just want to remind folks, and this gets to the globalization and the connections between these cities, that in September of 2014, we didn't know how that Ebola virus would play out. CDC, I believe, estimated that there would be 20,000 fatalities and then it would burn out. So they were a little high, but they were in the right ballpark. WHO, if I recall correctly, estimated 1.2 million fatalities from that outbreak. And the reason they were wrong wasn't because they were stupid or that their methodology was flawed. They just didn't assume rapid containment of the threat. And they could easily have been right. Mm-hmm. And next time, I'm afraid, they might very well be. So that's part of why we've got to, generalize these practices and work together and share, information on outbreaks as quickly as we can.
I do think, just one other comment will go to this question, is that the part of the challenge on this information sharing is a little bit what you just said about mayors, right? So the infrastructure is not there. How are the mechanisms supported? It's either by philanthropy or by corporations or by government. And that investment in information sharing is not made, or is it not sufficient? We're doing a lot of work. We've got about 30-some places in the U.S., about 15 internationally, with which we're interacting regularly on these issues, various issues. But that still doesn't get you to scale, right, with 40 people. So you don't scale up. And the other challenge is that it was to your point originally about these are siloed activities, and what this does is show the interconnectivity of these issues to be fragile or resilient. And so you've got the mayors, and the mayors are talking to the mayors. You've got the community development people, they're talking to the other community development people. You've got the infrastructure people, they're talking to each other. But these are cross-sector coalition issues, and there isn't a mechanism that has been effective even to recognize that this is something. We're doing stuff on economic development and workforce development. Those systems, after 20 or 30 years of trying, still don't interact effectively with each other and are not measured on the same goals. So I think it's like a very fundamental problem of resources, scale, and even if it's the right groups meeting together. So we'll solve that next. Sir, you had a question.
Herb Rose. I'll start off with a confession that I know very little about this subject. But I have limitations of knowledge in this area, but I also am a skeptic. I wonder about the methodology that you use, because I've heard you use a lot of qualitative terms, not very many quantitative terms. I wonder how you measure these things and what weight you put on each factor, and whether the same weight is used in each city that you study, and how transferable these factors are from one place to another.
Yeah. It's a great question. The first point I'll mention is that what we created is not meant to be an index. It's not meant to rank cities in any sense of fragility, et cetera. It's meant to create awareness, right? But in terms of the methodology, it's much easier to measure the factors of fragility that we mentioned there. I mean, we're talking about unemployment rate, we're talking about homicides. You know, these are relatively standardized sets, right? That exist, albeit different cities, different countries measure them differently. So there are some serious limitations there that we need to work on. When it comes to measuring resilience, that's a nut. That is very hard to crack, particularly when you're talking about the social cohesion, strong community, government relationships, right? These kinds of things require qualitative assessment. So that's what we haven't mapped out resilience yet, right? In terms of, but that's something that should be done because fragility is only half the picture. So in terms of weighting, they're all equally weighted at this point. Because for one thing, how are you to justify which variable is more important across multiple contexts, right? The scientific kind of proof or validity of doing so is extremely difficult. So these are all equally weighted to this point. It's the first stab. It's something that we've done over the past basically year and a half. Hopefully it will continue with much more vigor.
First, the man in the tie, then back there, and then I'll get back up to our Brookings alum.
This tie?
Yes. Sandy Apgar, CSIS, and a friend of Brookings Metro. It's ironic in some ways that the military is in this country, the UK, Canada, Australia, elsewhere, have been pioneers in the engaging business, private enterprise in general, in their infrastructure. And I'm separating the warfighting aspects from everything that supports the warfighter. Within your framework, how do business institutionally, private enterprise more broadly, particularly its entrepreneurial initiating functions, fit?
That's a great question. I mean, I just came before this, came from lunch with somebody who works for the insurance industry, right? They look at something like this and they say, okay, here we have a framework to be able to understand multiple risks, right? At a global scale. We can use this to complement our own kind of risk profiling. So that's one key area. The other is to use this for mayors, et cetera, to use this as a tool to engage the private sector, right? So if it's dealing with, for instance, infrastructure-related issues, they know how to engage. So that's one other aspect to deal with it. And I mentioned earlier the idea of when it comes to looking through resilience, one of the key factors we've seen across continents and multiple areas has been access to credit, right? And so here, this is something that the private sector in particular is probably the only engine that can provide viable, longer-term access to credit for cities and individuals working in cities longer-term in these markets that have been off the radar screen. So I see this as a platform for engagement, as a platform for also critique and self-interrogation, and possibly as something that can be used to help further buttress or deepen what exists out there in terms of political risk and instability analysis.
I mean, Mike, you uncovered across all the dimensions of securing global cities analysis that the private sector role, which you normally think about security as a public sector role, that the private sector role actually was emerging or strong in various ways. Maybe you can give a little comment on that.
Couple of examples. Some of the most impressive were in Detroit that we saw in this project, in especially the area downtown where Quicken Loans and others have their hub of businesses, and they wanted to revitalize downtown Detroit by moving there, but they needed to be safe. So they created a network of sensors and their own armed but unauthorized to shoot patrol officers. And basically linked all the information they were collecting into police who could actually do something about a problem as it might have been unfolding beyond just simply defending themselves. And so that was sort of the beginning of this way of thinking, at least as I understand some of the evolution in modern Detroit. But there are a couple of other institutions like Wayne State University that recognized that they also needed to make their campuses safe and needed to and some hospitals that wanted to worry about things that could go wrong, whether, you know, some kind of an act of violence or some kind of a breakdown in infrastructure. They needed to be plugged into the police. So people started building essentially communications grids that allowed their eyes and ears to be shared across the public-private space. And then one last example of that same kind of thing, but at the very local level, individual gas station owners got this offer, and it wasn't just gas stations, but convenience stores, other places that get held up at night. And they basically, I think they call it the green light program, and they basically have a deal where if you're a business owner and you buy the light and the camera, then the police will let you plug in your feed to their system. And from that point on, they are in a quick response mode, potentially, to defend your property. So those were just several examples that were very striking in just Detroit specifically, which, of course, in broader terms, has huge, huge challenges still before it. But that's part of why you saw such innovation, I think, that people realized they couldn't wait for a perfect fix from authorities. They had to start working piecemeal and locally and with the private sector.
Still have that question back there?
Thank you. Larry Altenberg is the name. I'm curious to know about recent examples, and in some cases not so recent examples, that you could put into your data, such as New Orleans and New York, that have a lot of pre-event, pre-disruption data, and then a lot of post-disruption data that could prove or disprove your methodology and enable us to better understand how the methodology would potentially apply to cities where we don't have any post-disruption data.
You know, it's a great question. And this is one other thing that got us to think about fragility more deeply, and one of the reasons why we mapped it out, which is actually no city is immune, right, to fragility. Many cities, including New Orleans or even New York, have some of the key fragility factors we're talking about. The question is, how do you mitigate against that, or how do you respond effectively to that? One of the individuals actually on our project advisory committee was from Siemens. He was also formerly part of the task force to Governor Bloomberg in the wake of Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, in terms of how to learn from the lessons there. So we've integrated to some degree some of those lessons. I think there is a lot to learn from places like New Orleans, New York. The question that was mentioned earlier about the transferability of some of those lessons is still, you know, a question mark. But I think here it's a key lesson, and one of the key takeaways from us was the issue that fragility, no one is immune, right?
And I think the other, I mean, when I hear those cities and the examples of Sandy and Katrina, you know, it's a resiliency question as much as a fragility that's evoked too, and I think gets to the value of finding some way to operationalize the resilience factors in your paper, and to, you know, I think you interestingly observe that these are not mutually exclusive categories. Being, as we talked about, being a very fragile place does not necessarily mean that you're not resilient. There's some 2x2 diagram, right, which has fragility on one axis and resiliency on the other, and being able to sort of plot where cities lie and how they move and evolve over time could be a really, it could lead to the development, I think, of a really interesting set of tools for urban leaders in terms of where you direct their focus to move them along the right axis or set of axes.
Mm-hmm. Just one additional point. Some of this you could do without the kind of empirical data that you're discussing. So, for example, if you're thinking about response to a major catastrophe, and let's say you either need to, heaven forbid, evacuate a city after a nuclear power plant disaster, or if you need to access a city when food and water have been cut off, you can evaluate transportation access, arteries, a number of lanes of highway relative to population that might need to be served. And if you're worried about certain kinds of infrastructure breaking, like transformers in electricity systems, you can think about what would be the response. So either having extra transformers lying around is one way to go. Most cities don't do that. We don't really do much of that. We probably should do a little more of that. But another way to think about it is what kind of federal emergency response has been practiced, what kind of capacity exists at the national level to move in. And so these are the various ways you could evaluate this without waiting to, for every city to be struck by a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And so some, but your question's right on, but I think there are certain ways where you could do this just by taking the next level of research and thinking through how you would operationalize this kind of resilience.
And just another, I think, compliment to John and his colleagues' work is the recognition that, that resilience or fragility is not only a measure of the quality of the infrastructure systems that can move people around out of the city, it's a question of social cohesion. And you observe in the fragility index that the concentration of poverty is a key contributor to fragility. And I think many correctly observing that the reason that so many people did not successfully evacuate New Orleans as Katrina approached was a question of social isolation, distrust between communities and local authorities. Even if the infrastructure had been great, I think that city would not have been as resilient in the face of Katrina.
Ken?
Excuse me, sir. Ken Lieberthal, Brookings Emeritus. This is a fascinating presentation you made. I was a bit troubled. I think, like a lot of the questions have reflected various members of the audience, your key here is fragility and resilience. Those are very dynamic concepts, but your data seem to be very static. So you're developing a kind of taxonomy of indicators, but without a test for whether those indicators are really critical in each instance to an eventual determination of how fragile or resilient a city is. And in different localities, what would be more important given that environment and social structure and the recent history of that locality. Do you intend or are you trying to partner with others to develop at least some notional models that would be dynamic that you can then test either into the future or, as a lot of climate scientists have learned to do, you develop a model and then test it against the past? You know, plug in data point, X. This is what the model would predict. Now let's see what we now know actually happened. Because otherwise, I'm a little afraid. I really like the focus you're directing at metropolitan areas. But I'm really troubled that it kind of has a packaging that is so dynamic and a reality that when you had your graphic up there of the different components that you're looking at, I thought, as I think a number of us did, yeah, but what's more important under what conditions? What are the definitions? For example, inequality of income? Did you mean inequality of wealth? Do you factor in degree of social mobility? That kind of thing. Even the definition of city. I know, as Mike mentioned earlier, I deal mostly with China. Cities in China, on the whole, certainly the larger cities, include vast rural areas within the city. And so would you define those cities as being just the central core, or do you include the administrative jurisdiction of the city? So I just ended up being both excited by what you're doing, but concerned that it may be too taxonomic and not sufficiently dynamic.
That's a fantastic observation and something we thought about a lot. The reality, as you mentioned, is these concepts at the national level, also at the city level, community level, are very dynamic, right? And in fact, you can see that dynamism if you go online. Because what we've done is to track it back 15 years. And you can play a button there that actually shows how fragility across these variables we've highlighted shifts. The Middle East lights up, right? Other places, dim down, et cetera. That is a very, very important factor. And in terms of, I think, as I mentioned earlier, this is not meant to be the definitive
or the only tool, right? It's meant to complement existing tools. One thing that we are planning to do, pending funding, is to actually test this out in a number of localities. We're looking at, right now, a couple of cities in Tanzania, Somalia as well, looking at Uganda, right, just to start. These are costly enterprises, right, very taxing, but necessary, as you mentioned, in order to understand, okay, you know, what matters most in what locality, and how are things actually changing over time? Populations are dynamic, right? Populations change, as do economic opportunities. And so there are things we need to keep a constant tab on. In terms of definition of cities, that was another key issue we encountered, right? In Canada, the definition of city is 10,000 people. In Japan, it's 100,000, right? We went with the UN definition of a city, which helps actually, you know, standardize things, but that's not without problems, right? Now you also have new categories of cities called super cities, right? City conglomerates, et cetera. So this whole field is extremely dynamic, something that we need to keep a constant tab on, and something that continually challenges us, and we don't want this to be a static kind of a study or a snapshot at a point in time. But what you say is absolutely a core challenge, a key challenge, and something that hopefully, you know, us with others can join on and start building on.
If I could add one footnote to that. So as we were finishing up this Securing Global City study, my good friend and colleague who's since moved on to California, Beth Pierce, was helping me, and we kept saying, you know, 66% of the world's population is going to live in cities by 2050. And I finally realized, said to her, I've been saying that so long, I never thought about what it meant. So what does it mean? Like, what's a city? And can we find out what a city is? And so she spent about a week on that. And I think ultimately, Ken, the answer is whatever a given country defines it to be. So I don't think there is a capacity yet. You can standardize what you define in terms of size to be a threshold for making your list.
Right.
But I don't think that there's consistency. Well, I know there's not consistency in how different countries define cities. But even analytically, if you wanted to create a common creature, you would need to do a whole other level of data analysis because the countries themselves are using their own definitions when they come up with their figures.
I'll take that in final question. I mean, this is true even in the United States, right? Because you go state to state and different cities or local jurisdictions have different capacities depending upon what the state imbued them with. And within the state, differences between cities and what they can do or can't do, tax, et cetera. And that's a real question here. So we got action from this response to fragility. There's economic, there's security issues. So much of this depends on resources. And you mentioned access to credit. If there's something that we take from this about the relationship between mayors or these city jurisdictions and the states, what would, and this could be in the security area too, what would that be? Do you have thoughts about what this has unveiled in terms of the limitations or the opportunities? I'll give it all three of you, and then we'll finish.
Who's starting?
Whoever feels most bold.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, as we highlighted in terms of some of the resilience factors, cooperation between multiple levels of government is absolutely essential, right? Where you see governments working well together, you know, recovery is faster. The nature of the disaster is mitigated. I mean, that goes without saying. I think one important thing, and what we tried to do here by looking, you know, at the literature base and the evidence base of you know, what seems to be to correlate most with fragility or resilience, is actually start a conversation about what are the factors we can focus on together. And who has the primary role in terms of delivering on those capacities. And use that as not a blueprint, but maybe as a starting point for action, right? And it's as you mentioned earlier, there are over 200 city networks talking, but they're talking in specific kind of areas. Can we start a horizontal dialogue that, you know, collectively brings those discussions together. So that would be my answer. Use this as a starting point. Understand roles and responsibilities. Understand more effectively how we can leverage certain resources from multiple, you know, actors. And then test it out to see if it's working or not.
Can I go second, and then Alan can correct whatever I get wrong?
Sure.
So building on that, very good answer. I would say one thing that struck me is that most of the expertise for securing cities is at the city level, except when it's not. except when the local police force or the local politician or the dynamic between them doesn't work. And so if it's working, it's because of locals. If it's not working, that's where the Fed has to step in more to get the locals to retry their approach or change their leadership. But the federal government has very little expertise in urban security. And I don't want to diss any individual agency, but they're just not that big. And their job, like with the FBI, their job is to go find a few specific bad guys who are elusive or who are crossing state boundaries or who are national security threats, you know, but they're a tiny organization. So the expertise is mostly at the city level, but the federal government is crucial, can provide information on who's on a terrorist watch list. It can, you know, put pressure on a city to agree to a consent decree and reform its police forces, can share best practices, try to create mechanisms by which best practices are shared city to city. So that's the way I would say it. I mean, I was struck that this is not like the U.S. military, where the expertise is central. In this case, the expertise is generally at the city level, it seems to me.
I would not correct any of that. I would merely augment from the economic side something that I think you're hinting at, Merrick, that our good friend Greg Clark wrote a book called Short History of Global Cities, available in the Brookings Bookstore. But he actually argues that many of the key economic challenges that cities face today will not be resolved by mayors talking to mayors or a global parliament of mayors or what have you. It's rather getting organized more deliberately to speak up to their nation states around, you know, level of resources, but the flexibility to apply those resources in ways that are most attuned to their specific local economic circumstances, and being given the powers by their nations, or in the United States, their states, to raise resources in ways that they're not permitted to do so right now because the states or the nations hold too much fiscal power, and the UK, among other countries, is dealing with this right now. But really, the more of the action for enhancing social cohesion, dealing with inequality, promoting social mobility and economic opportunity is a conversation to be had between cities, between mayors and governors and national leaders versus among global mayors.
That just brings it back to the point you made up front about identifying the roles and responsibilities. You want to give the website one more time so that people can find this information?
Sure. So it's hosted at the Igarapé Institute's homepage, which is www.igarape.org.br. fragilecities.igarape.org.br.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking our panelists. Thank you for coming.